session number 22333, wheel 8.
Can we continue by you telling us, Jim, what it was like then going on to Adelaide from Western Australia?
Yes, well, we were on the Kosciuszko, the same ship that we'd come from Bombay on, and not much change, but there weren't, of course, there weren't so heavily many troops on board, and but it was quite a quick trip across the Bight, and I don't remember much about it. We arrived in Adelaide, and we were tracked out to a camp practically in Adelaide, but on the outer suburb named Springbank, and there we went into tents. We camped in tents, and we stayed there. We didn't do any training. One or two little route marches, but he stayed there got reorganized, I suppose you'd say, and then most of the troops, the battalion, got leave to return to Perth. I think it's what they call five or seven days leave. That is, that meant that when they got, after they had the train journey, they still had 5 or 7 days at home before they retrained to come back to Adelaide. Well, that didn't happen. They didn't come back to Adelaide. They went straight up to New South Wales. I myself had been put in a sergeant in 2IC of the AWL troops that had gradually filtered in to Springbank after being rounded up in Australia, in Western Australia, Perth, and sent back. And we moved from there, about 100, 120 of these chaps, up to Glen Innes on the Tablelands in New South Wales. And there we camped in newly completed huts had been put up by the CSI, or whatever they call the construction units. They're generally men of past military age, and we camped there. I was in charge then of a few chaps who had been caused a bit of trouble, and the AWL. And they went AWL, and there were four or five of them, and they were lodged in the local jail at Glen Innes. And I had to go in every morning and check up and see with their rations and see if everything was okay. And nearly every morning that I went in there, the sergeant's wife used to round on me and say she just couldn't understand how I could be treating these very, very nice people as I was, lock them up in jail. They shouldn't be there. That they're behaving beautifully, they're helping her in the garden, and they even want to do some drying up, washing up for her in the kitchen. And that was the impression she got, which was probably quite true. These men were good men, but they had gone AWL, and when they shouldn't have, and then they resisted arrest or something like that. And anyhow, we were there for a while, and eventually the officer and four other men, NCOs, were given leave to come back to Western Australia. I wasn't given leave because I'd been pulled out to go to a militia unit, which I didn't want to happen, and that was back in Springbank, and I'd gone up to with the company commander to Glen Innes, and I was still supposed to be detached from the battalion. Anyhow, I came back to West Australia with the other men by acting as a batman to the officer. Whenever he went, I picked up his kit bag and his pack and suitcase and carried those. And when I was asked for my leave pass, my hands full, I just couldn't get it. And I eventually got back to Perth and had a very good leave in Perth for the simple reason that the five of us couldn't get back to Adelaide, couldn't get back to the east, because the trains were fully occupied by units and they didn't take any odds and sods, as we called them. Anyhow, we were living in Perth, and one day I went down to Claremont, where we had to report the showgrounds, and we were there, and thinking as usual, oh well, we'll just have to report in and go back to Perth. But suddenly, one of the men who we were reporting to came up and said, "Righto, hurry up, you're off." And we said, "But there's no train going." And he said, "No, you're going by sea." So we went down to Fremantle then, the five of us, and got on the Dominion Monarch, which was a very lovely boat, I think it was about 29,000 tonne. That had just come back from the Middle East and had New Zealanders on board. They were the NCOs and a few officers, mainly NCOs, no ORs, but mainly NCOs, but they'd been picked to come back and be the nucleus of the formation of a new division in New Zealand. Beside them, there were a lot of baddies, criminals, from the jails in Jerusalem, who had been sent home to be tried in Australia and jailed in Australia. We had an uneventful voyage, but the night before we got to Sydney, the ship suddenly turned around and went full speed out the way we'd come. We couldn't understand it, and we weren't told why it was. We just couldn't understand why this was happening. We found out next morning, when we had turned around again and come back in, that the midget submarines had come into Sydney Harbour. And that was the reason why we turned around and went back to sea. We saw them with one submarine that had surfaced in the harbour, and there were little boats, and there was a panic on in the harbour, no doubt about it. We didn't actually see where their torpedo had hit a supply ship, but we heard about it later. Anyhow, we went ashore, and eventually from there, after 3 or 4 days in Sydney, we went up to Mooloolaba, where our battalion was camped. And there we were situated about 60 miles north of Brisbane on what is known as the Brisbane Line. And we were told then that was the line. Anything north of that was going to be very lightly defended. And where we were was the main position for the defence of southern Australia.
What was the general feeling?
Knowing we all know?
Yep. What was the general feeling to do with the fact that the Japanese had made it into Sydney Harbour with their midget subs?
It was a panic. The Sydney side had really panicked, in our opinion, and something they never expected. And it shelled Newcastle, I think about 2 days, 2 nights afterwards. Not only when I say shell, I think only 2 or 3 shells landed there. But there was a general bit of a panic in Sydney among the people. It didn't affect us, of course. But we left Sydney and returned to the battalion up in on the Brisbane Line. The battalion had not stayed, I had not spent much time at Glen Innes, I'd moved straight to Brisbane. And when we joined them there, it was general training, mainly route marches, hard marches, and very little what you call jungle training, because there wasn't a jungle there. It was mainly, what I remember was sugar cane plantations, but there's plenty of route marches and plenty of hills to climb. I personally did not have to do much of that. I was still detached from the battalion, even though I was with the battalion. I was not actually a member, I could suppose. And I was given odd jobs like going down to Brisbane and picking up horses to take back, ex-light horses. Horses had been used as mounts in the light horse. We took them back, another chap and I took them back to the camp, and there they allotted to the officers. Some of the officers to ride. And I was made sergeant of a NCO training camp on the sea front in Maroochydore, where we were training NCOs.
Can you tell us what that involved?
Yeah, mainly instructions on compass work and nothing to do with fortifications or that sort of thing. Mainly a lot of night work, and I suppose that's what I could say. We had to take them on night compass marches and instruct them for night work. Mainly that was their training. Nothing to do with the actual battalion manoeuvres or anything like that. It was just purely night training.
Before we go on too much further, I'm interested to ask you, you were talking about the criminals on board the ship that you came back on. What had they been convicted of, or what had been their main crimes in the Middle East?
That I don't know, because some I know were for raping, one or two for murdering, I understand, for murders. But generally, they were bad types, really bad types. And they had this jail in Jerusalem where they put these types. It was something like the British had their glass house, but of course nowhere near as severe as a glass house. But they were there, and they were to be held. And the thing was that they were so severe, I understand, that the crimes, they couldn't be tried in the Middle East. They had to come back to Australia.
I was wondering whether.
And while they were on board the ship, they had to have a preliminary court martial that they hadn't had before while they were in the Middle East, and that was the preliminary court martial before they were brought back and given the civil or whatever the court convictions in Australia. And we had to hold, they held the court martial on board. I was lucky. I'd been worded about these and told to volunteer for submarine watch, which I did, which result I got out of having anything to do with the court martials.
I was wondering whether at all it was practice for some of the soldiers to commit crimes to get out of the army, to avoid.
No, I've never heard of that. As far as I know, I've never heard. They might have feigned illness or something like that. But I never heard of them committing a crime to get out of the army. Oh no, that would be too silly. The army wasn't that bad. At that stage, anyhow. Later on, I know chaps who couldn't go back into action. They committed suicide in preference to go back to action because they couldn't take the stress of fighting. But I never heard anything about that.
Well, let's go back then to where you were explaining the training of NCOs.
Yeah. Well, there we're training NCOs. We had no knowledge of what was happening. We never heard anything about Japanese, what they were doing or where it was. We were purely, everything was heavily censored. it was a, in some ways a bit of a joke, because the way we were handled by the heads. Now I often think about it, because while we were in camp in Northam, the VDC were the chaps who were in Northam, where I came from. It was on the pipeline to Kalgoorlie, and they were given little sections of the pipeline to patrol at night time, because the talk was that somebody might blow the enemy, what they call fifth columnist was a popular expression in those days, might come along and blow up a portion of the pipeline so water couldn't reach the wheat belt and Kalgoorlie. And of course the joke was the pipeline was over 300 miles long, and yet they'd given just a little section to look after. Well, now, while we were in camp at Maroochydore, I and another sergeant were told that we had to go and spy, observe, I suppose would be a better word, on a little farmhouse. And we were told that it was occupied by a German and his wife. I have an idea that they were Australian, had Australian citizenship, but they had been very, very, very good friends of a German who was commander of a raider in the First World War. And he, when he visited Australia, he stayed with them. And they were told, or we were told, that they were very, very good friends. This was about 15 miles from our camp. No, about 10 miles from our camp. And we were taken there by truck on dark, and told to stay there till daylight, when the truck would come and pick us up and take us back to camp. Well, now, the first night we went there, we stayed in some bush where we could observe the door, front door of the house, which we did, and it was moonlight, wasn't pitch dark, it was moonlight, and that happened. Each night we went there and got out of the truck, went there, a dog barked, and we went there, I say we were there for three nights. On the third night, the door opened and a gentleman came out and walked across to where we were. The dog came with him, and he invited us in for tea or cocoa. And, of course, we were surprised. And he told us then that in the night we went there, the dog had barked. Next morning, the dog had led him to the place where we were camped, and which he then I knew that something was wrong. So every night after that, instead of staying out in the bush looking at him, we went and stayed with him till, I think, about 8 or 10 o'clock at night, and with he and his wife, and they talked to us. Actually, at home now, I have two little paintings that he gave me, lovely little paintings of a tree that he painted in the park in Brisbane. But they were the silly things that happened in the course where we during the war, that the heads didn't seem to know what they're doing. Instead of employing proper men to counter spy, they used untrained troops, like I was. Mm. And Count von Lucknow was the name of the commander. His ship, I understand, was known as the Sea Eagle in the First World War, and I think that on another ship he eventually later on visited Australia, but he was a very well-known raider, sea raider of Allied shipping in the First World War, and that was the reason why they suspected this gentleman of spying. I might mention here that there seemed to be a lot of Germans or ex-Germans in Brisbane, like it was in South Australia, and they had a very, very nice club, German club in Brisbane, that we went down later on, and when I went to school, and we occupied that club.
What was their feeling towards the war? Did you ever speak to them about the way they felt about things?
They were very, very anti-Hitler when they spoke about it. Very anti-Hitler. And they were very, very surprised. I remember this quite well. They were very, very surprised that Hitler had gone into Poland and those countries, because he thought that had never happened. That the Poles and the Germans were so close together that it would never happen. But that's all I remember. We talked to him about it and discussed him, but actually we played cards and had convivial evenings with him. And after that, I did two stints at the school, and we never heard a word about going to New Guinea or anywhere like that. We were purely there to defend the Brisbane line, and we had the rest of the battalions. I only went on one or two of them. Had these tremendous marches where they had to do 30 and 40 miles a day with full packs up for training, but I don't think they ever did any jungle training. I don't know how they did a bit of rifle shooting on the range, but the training was mainly route marching and getting fit. Because the idea was that we were to defend that area. We didn't drink trenches or anything else. It was going to be, when I say Brisbane Line, there were no fortifications of anything that I can remember of. It was a case of living and fighting in that type of country.
What was the feeling then of the threat of the Japanese and how you might be able to stop them if they did come?
Never discussed it. We, in that NGO school, we talked about certain things, fighting against the enemy, and it was terrific. It was a case of enemy, I suppose, to have vehicles that we were going to ambush and kill and destroy and things like that with grenades and a bit of TNT and things like that, but there's no actual discussion about jungle fire, jungle fighting, nothing at all about jungle fighting. And when the last school ended, and the NCOs went back to the battalion, and I went back to the battalion, or actually never went to the battalion, I went straight to Brisbane with my haversack, and thought I'd take two or three days leave in there, and I was in Brisbane, and I got word. Well, I didn't get word. I heard that there's a chance of the battalion moving. So I immediately went back and joined the battalion. As I got back to the camp, the last truck was pulling out, and a friend, my fellow corporal, or those days we were corporals together, he said, come on, farmer, we're off. And I ran, and I jumped on the back of this truck with my haversack, and I finished up in New Guinea. We never heard a word about going to New Guinea. It was supposed to be a silent move to Brisbane by night onto the ship. It was a Liberty ship. And when we got to, we were loading onto the ship, there was a strike. The wharf is in Brisbane, went on strike. I understand it was for 2 shillings an hour more for loading ammunition. Well, now, we'd been handing this 2-inch mortar ammunition all our army training. We'd been handing this ammunition. Or in the Middle East, we hadn't trained with it before we went to the Middle East. And then we just couldn't understand it. And some of the chaps wanted to go down to where the wharfies were having their tucker and in their huts and have it out with them. But the officers wouldn't let us do it, or I wasn't one of them. I understood the also stopped some of the other chaps from going down to do it. And but eventually we loaded the ammunition onto the ship ourselves, got on the Liberty ship. It was purely a ship that had nothing on board except an engine and a bridge. The rest was nothing of the rest. It was purely a cargo ship with big holes in it. The troops camped down in the holes or on deck. Our cooking was all done on deck with burners, petrol burners, and the latrines were board rigged over the side of the ship. And when you want to do your business, you went and sat on this board on the side of the ship and did your business. And that's how rough it was.
What were your feelings?
Rough is rough.
What were your feelings of this treatment that you were receiving?
It was the army. We took no notice. It was just the way the army were dealt in the army with. We never queried it. We moaned and groaned and things like that. And some chaps camped down below, just below the decks, and when these burners used to burn, light up the heat, they'd go right through the decks and they'd be driven out. They'd have to come on deck themselves, which was very, very crowded. Very crowded indeed. There were no life flasks or anything like that. We just had, I don't even remember having life belts issued to us. But we just lived on the ship for the 2 or 3 days it took us to get to Moresby. We had no idea we were going to Moresby. We just didn't have a clue where we were going. We were on the ship and we were just going. When we finished up in Moresby, we alighted ashore. The ship stayed out in the harbour. There was no jetty for it. We alighted ashore, straight on the trucks, through a very hot little town. We saw how badly, just in daytime, we saw how badly bombed it had been. And all that was deserted. All the houses seemed to be deserted, the office buildings. And it was very hot and dry. And this would be about midday, I presume, I remember. Anyhow, we got in some more trucks and went up to the foothills. And as soon as we got to the foothills, it just poured with rain, really heavy rain. We never in our lives had rain like that. And some of the chaps, to protect themselves, had a truck was slowly climbing up the hill. A chap would hop out and grab a banana leaf from the banana plants and come back and hold over 2 or 3 of the chap's head to try and stop the rain from beating on us. But that's what quite a few of us did there. Anyhow, just on nightfall we got to this camping place where we camped and stayed there for 2 nights, I think it was, before we went up the Owen Stanleys. Might have been 3 nights.
Can you tell us what that place was like where you were to camp before you head off?
Yes, well, at that stage, I might say I'd rejoined the battalion because I was given the command of a platoon. The platoon were a transport platoon who had their vehicles had been taken from them and left behind in Moresby, and they had been converted or given rifles. They always had rifles, but they were maybe made infantry men to the transport drivers, and I was given command of those. I had the platoon, I was the sergeant, and I should have been officer in the battalion, but he was a transport officer, but he'd gone to headquarter company and had the command of the pioneers and as well as the transport platoon.
What was your general feeling of the place that you were in now, New Guinea?
The feeling was it rained and rained and rained. In the foothills, I say it rained 3 o'clock in the afternoon, rained all that night, and it stopped next morning. That's how our feeling was. But we didn't have any clue. All we knew, we were going to fight the Japs, and we were very, very keen to do that. We thought we were well trained, which we weren't. But we were very fit, mighty fit. Even the transport platoon were very fit men because they'd had to do route marches and things like that. And Oh no, we haven't rung them, but we sharpened bayonets and we're doing this sort of work, getting ready. And we were handed car keys, summer clothes, and with a little packet of dye. And we dipped these, we had buckets, and we dipped these clothes into buckets. And it didn't make any difference whether we stood there in the rain, it didn't make any difference. We were getting wet. And we stood these, put these clothes into the buckets with the dye in it, and took them out. And they'd changed colour. That's all that happened to them. They'd changed colour. They'd gone from dark, from a light khaki to a dark green. And eventually, we found out that the rain just washed the dye out, so they became light green again.